This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Age of Empire, written by Michael J. Sullivan, performed by Tim Gerard Reynolds.
Author's note. Hello, and welcome to this final installment of The Legends of the First Empire. This book marks the 16th novel in my fictional world of Elan, and the conclusion to the age of myths and legends that forms the foundation of my previous series. This book is releasing at an unprecedented time in our history. As I write this, it is April 2020. The coronavirus pandemic is rampant throughout the world, and people are sequestered in lockdowns, families trapped in involuntary staycations. Early Kickstarter readers who seem to be hoping to escape their four walls and perhaps the daily news have been flooding my inbox with emails, clamoring for the book. Robin and I have struggled, but we managed to keep a schedule for the ebook and audiobook versions. We were thrilled the printer could produce the book at all, and it was just 3 weeks late. While most people have struggled with stay-at-home orders, life here in the valley hasn't changed much. As most of you already know, we live in a cabin in the mountains of Virginia. Being a full-time writer with a wife who is my editor, agent, business manager, and publicist means that we have long lived the lives of hermits, by choice. In the past, we have invited people from all over the world to the cabin. We have enjoyed the company of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists, retired military generals, famous as well as aspiring authors, fans of my work, and even a few who had no idea who I am or what I do. All of that stopped in 2020. Of course, and when we come out on the other side of this, I hope we can return to hosting people. So if your travel plans ever take you to Luray, Virginia, drop us an email, michael@michaelsullivan-author.com, and we'll have you by for a drink. For those who cannot come here, there is a possibility that we might come to you. Earlier this year, Robin and I bought a Jeep and a teardrop camper with plans of doing some traveling. Once the virus-imposed restrictions are off, we hope to start. Over the years, several people have said, if you're ever in insert various place, let us know. And because we have lived like hermits, we unfortunately didn't write those down. But now there's a link on my website where you can go and let us know where you live. If it turns out that we'll be passing nearby, we'll see if we can meet up. As it turned out, that teardrop camper came at just the right time. Robin became ill at the end of March, and she's been isolating in it. Finishing this book has been interesting, to say the least. Robin and I work via Discord, going over typos reported by the Gamma and early Kickstarter readers. Usually, we'd be in the studio while Tim records, something we've always looked forward to. However, that wasn't possible this time. We did receive the dailies and were able to communicate changes via emails. Thanks to Tim's in-home studio, he was able to stay mainly on schedule, and that saved the audiobook's release date. As always, our heartfelt thanks go out to Tim and our undying gratitude to the extra work he put in. He had to work alone, without an engineer or director, but his efforts meant the audiobooks released wasn't affected by the crisis. So the long journey is finally at an end. I don't think I've fully processed that yet. Getting this book out in May fulfilled the promise Robin made. Keeping that pledge was important to her. My hope is that this book has the power, in some small way, to help. I want to think we've created something good and lasting that can be shared, a doorway through which you can go and catch your breath, ease some stress, and perhaps even remember how to smile. Here's hoping that everyone who started reading this series will be able to finish it, because that would mean the specter passed by your door. Stay safe. Keep your spirits up, and join with me now for the next and last journey into the legends of the First Empire.
Chapter 1. Hitting Bottom.
People often speak about hitting bottom. They have no idea what they are talking about. The Book of Brin. In the eternal silence and absolute darkness of the abyss's unimaginable depths, Ivar heard a scream. Faint at first, it grew to a piercing wail, then stopped, cut short by a loud clap. Sounds were rare in his neighborhood, light even more so. And yet he did see a dim illumination seeping into the entrance of his cave. Prior to the howl, there had been a rapid series of booms. Ivar hadn't bothered to investigate those, as he wouldn't have been able to see anything, and the effort of crawling would have been wasted. But the cry was different. Ivar was certain the voice was familiar. Someone had fallen into the abyss. Someone he knew. With great effort, he willed himself to stand. Few things drove Ivar to such ridiculous extremes as walking, but this was a special occasion. He was certain who had fallen. He recognized that voice, that scream. Ivar held out his hands, searching for the wall, then followed it around to the narrow crack that formed the entrance to his place. He refused to call it home. Home meant something else. Warmth and comfort. Even at the most miserable of times, a home served as a locale with merit, possessing an appeal beyond mere shelter. His cave served only as a place to be, a spot to sit, a hole to hide in. He couldn't recall the last time he'd left his place. This didn't surprise Ivar, as he was finding it increasingly difficult to remember just about anything. He still knew his name. The first part, at least. There had been more. A qualifier of some sort, but he couldn't figure out what that might have been. His life was fading. Memories dissolving. The last significant event he could summon up was meeting Edvard, a Gula of Clan Erling. Ivar had only been dead a short time when the man had beaten and dragged Ivar to the cliff. It wasn't until he was falling that Ivar realized why the man threw him over the edge. From high above, the Gula shouted, "This is for my wife, Rhianna, you fat bastard! May you forever rot!" Ivar had expected something horrifying waiting at the bottom. What he had found was nothing, which turned out to be even worse. But now... Creeping out of the cave, Ivar saw a white glow coming off something on the ground not far away. At that distance, it appeared to be a bag of something, clothes, perhaps. He remembered those. Drawing nearer, he saw it was a person. He shouldn't have been surprised. The biggest event in what felt like a century had turned out to be nothing more than a casualty of some brutal combat. Some poor wretch had fallen to the depths known to all as the Abyss, the absolute bottom from which no one returned. He moved closer and found the small frame of a woman with dark, short-cropped hair, or rather, what was left of her.
"I'm certain I recognize that scream."
Ivar felt excitement rise for the first time in, well, he hadn't a clue how long it had been, but his high hopes were dashed when experience chastised him.
"Not possible. There's no way it could be her."
The fall had left the woman crushed on the hard frost, the price of admission to the worst level of existence. Ivar surmised that every bone was broken and her skull shattered. Most of her body was lost in crumpled cloth. But Ivar based the diagnosis on his own experience. It had taken an eternity to pull himself together. Even now, he had no idea how successful he'd been. In the abyss, there were no reflections. Reaching the woman's crumpled form, Ivar realized she seemed to have fared better than he. Even so, her body was unnaturally twisted, her eyes open, alert, and still in her head. When they spotted him, both went wide. She attempted to scream again, but the only thing that came out was a wet gurgle. "Roan," Ivor said, shocked to discover his voice worked. "It is you." Broken as she was, the woman struggled to inch away. Mounted on a broken neck, her head swiveled to one side. "Roan, you've come back to me." She managed to moan through broken teeth and pooling blood. "Oh, yes," he said. "I'm here. We'll get you fixed up in no time. Won't that be nice?" At the comment, her eyes grew wider still. They might yet fall out. Ivor bent down and gathered Roan in his arms. Her snapped bones hung limp, feeling eerily like a bag of split firewood. She moaned, and a tear slipped down her cheek and fell to the frozen ground. "Don't worry, my dear," he grinned at her. "Once you're put back together, it'll be like old times." The moment Bryn's fingers slipped off the edge of the bridge and she felt herself plunge into the abyss, panic had taken hold. At first, her mind froze, locked by a singular idea. "This can't be happening." Then, as she fell deeper into darkness, she wondered what hitting the bottom would feel like. She hoped she would bounce, but figured the effect to be more like a dropped icicle. "Will I shatter into a million pieces?" After an inexplicably long time, Bryn discovered she wanted it to be over. There was no avoiding the collision, no saving herself, and the waiting threatened to drive her insane. Anticipating the impact, knowing it could come at any time, was the real terror. She closed her eyes, didn't want to see. "Get it over with already!" Then it happened. Bryn touched down with all the force of having leapt from the front porch of the lodge, a whopping 4 steps, landing feet first. The momentum pushed her torso forward. Her palms slapped the ground and prevented any real harm. Only the heel of her left hand suffered a wound, a slight abrasion from scraping the granular frost that covered the ground. It stung for a moment. She straightened and stood, staring at the frozen rock that formed the bottom of the world. Imagining herself breathing, Bryn saw her exhalation created a fog, the way it always had in the depths of winter. "That wasn't so bad," she thought, relief pouring in. The light, however, did catch her by surprise. Pure white, and without an apparent source, it illuminated the new world around her. She could see from one side of the canyon to the other. Cliffs rose, their tops disappearing into darkness. She was at the bottom of the abyss, and nothing was there except a vast, frost-covered plain of uneven ground and miserly ripples of snow that had been blown by a long-extinct wind. "Roan," she called out, but got no answer. Bryn had seen her friend fall, so she should be close by. Perhaps she wandered off. It would be exactly like her to go exploring, curiosity eclipsing everything else. Wondering if anyone else had slipped over the edge the way she had, Bryn looked up, but saw nothing. "I hope everyone else is all right. I'm alone down here, except for Roan. I really need to find her." Walking in no particular direction, Bryn found herself in a maze of fissures, which branched off into narrow canyons that zigzagged into the dark. These gashes were no doubt the reason for the many bridges they had traversed while traveling across the plain of Kilcorth on their way to King Midian's castle. The impossibly high walls were as porous as a sponge, and dark holes and caves peppered their surface. Some were at ground level, others higher up, and extending as far as she could see. From time to time, Bryn paused and called out for Roan. Her voice didn't travel far. The abyss was a quiet place, its silence broken by the harsh crackle of her feet on the frosty ground. Roan didn't respond, so Bryn picked an offshoot at random and ventured down one of the side branches. She guessed there were dozens of these tributaries, perhaps hundreds, and it could take a long while to search each one. But time was all she had now. Eventually, she would find Roan. This would be the Keeper's quest for as long as it took, and the reward would be maintaining her sanity. Searching gave her something to do beyond wallowing in self-pity for her failure. The deeper into the ravine she went, the narrower it became. Given the open space where she had touched down, this confinement gave her an unexpected sense of security. Her dog, Darby, had often crawled under a table or bed when frightened, and Bryn's father had explained that animals sometimes found small places comforting. Bryn now felt that same sense of sheltered protection, and she was surprised that the abyss wasn't frightening. The worst she could say about it was that it seemed more than a little cold. And lonely, the idea popped into her head. What if each person falls into their own separate abyss? Is that why I can't find Roan? Now she was scared, and she recoiled from the notion the way she instinctively pulled back her hand after touching a hot pot. She tried to calm herself. No reason to think like that. Not yet. She shook off the possibility and tried to focus. Roan might have crawled into one of the many caves the way Darby had wriggled under the bed. Roan! She called out again. This time, she was rewarded by movement. From where she stood, she could see a shifting shadow some way up the cliff's craggy face, where no vegetation grew. She watched, hoping to see the familiar figure of her friend. Crossing to the opposite side of the gorge, she got a better look and wondered why Roan would be up so high. Then Bryn realized it wasn't Roan. This silhouette was too short and wide. Whatever it was, she didn't think it was human. What would Moya do? After taking a calming breath, Bryn set her jaw, squared her shoulders, and inched closer. As she did, she spotted more holes in the honeycombed cliff. Most weren't big enough to be considered true caves, just little cracks and fractures. Drawing nearer, Bryn saw more shadows. Figures crawled out of holes, each of them with two arms, two legs, and one head. They were generally in the shape of people, but it was obvious they weren't runes, Frey, or dwarfs. These figures appeared to be made of partially melted wax. Shoulders were sloped and limbs elongated. Faces were merely vague contours with lumps where noses or cheeks ought to be. Some only had a slight indentation instead of a mouth. Bryn felt her stomach twist. Dozens, scores, perhaps hundreds, slipped out from cracks and ledges. Many appeared as shriveled as raisins. Others were not much more than lumps, and in some places she saw only oozing pools of thick slime. Bryn stayed clear of the moving shadows, which was easy to do given how slowly they crawled. With them came a sliding, dragging slurp. The noise a snail might make if it were 5 feet long. Splat! The sound was so close, Bryn jumped. Spinning, she discovered that one of the creatures had fallen from the heights, landing near her heels. Little more than a glob of ooze, it had one eye that peered up at her. Its mouth moved like a sock puppet, silently opening and closing. Terrified, Bryn stumbled backward, grimacing. What in the name of the grandmother of all is that? Plop. Slip. Plop. Clap. Dozens more fell from everywhere at once. They landed near and far, in front and behind. Hundreds oozed out of the ground-level caves, creeping, sliding, and dragging their misshapen bodies across the crackling frost. Each one coming toward her. Gifford hit the ground, twisting an ankle and hammering a knee and a hip. The impact hurt, but it wasn't too bad. A lifetime of tumbling had made him an expert at falling and dealing with the aftermath. Despite the infamous reputation of the Abyss, Gifford didn't even think this was his worst fall. After only a moment to collect himself, he was able to stand. A fortifying breath allowed him to shake off the pain, and he straightened up to search for Roan. When he'd last seen his wife, a flying creature had pulled her off the bridge. Moya had tried to save Roan by hitting her attacker with an arrow, but she'd been too late. When the Bancor dropped Roan, she was a long way up and too far out to land on the span leading to the Allison door. Burned into his memory was Roan's terrified scream, which faded only with distance. He tried to follow, ran for the edge of the bridge and planned to dive, but Rain had stopped him. Well-intentioned as the dwarf had been, he simply didn't understand. Rain wasn't saving Gifford's life. Gifford's life had already fallen into the abyss. Pivoting completely around, Gifford didn't find Roan. What he did see was snow. No flakes fell, but the ground was covered. A white sheet as far as he could see, which wasn't far. A light was nearby, but it had a limited distance. Where the brilliance came from, Gifford couldn't tell. Neither from above nor from behind, the radiance extended outward in every direction, casting back the eternal night like a lantern. Gifford was back in his traveling clothes. The armor made by Alberich Berling had disappeared, so that wasn't the source. Getting to his feet, he took a step, and the light moved with him. It's me! He looked at his hands, but they weren't glowing. I'm seeing what I expect, and I wouldn't be pleased with glowing hands. That would be more than strange. It would be frightening. This new world was a barren landscape of frozen rock and washboard snowdrifts. Dark walls surrounded him, the height lost to the darkness beyond his radiance. Gifford took a few steps. Snow crackled under his feet. Nothing so pretty or welcome as deep fluff. This was a thin, bitter crust, more a frost than flakes. Again, he made a quick circle, searching for Roan, but finding nothing. Then he heard screaming. From overhead and growing in volume came a pair of cries. They wailed toward him at an astonishing speed before being silenced by massive claps. Gifford ran toward the nearest impact and found a woman lying unnaturally splayed out, one leg bent backward, her neck twisted too far, her head crushed the way one might expect a melon to appear after a drop from a second-story window. Her eyes were open but unseeing. A small stream of blood trailed from one nostril. Tressa, he said. No reaction. The edge of Gifford's light revealed the other person. Tesh lay face down, arms and legs spread out. The left side of his face appeared to be driven halfway into the ground. Gifford guessed the stone was undamaged. It was Tesh's skull that had caved in. His jaw was unhinged, his teeth scattered in a spray of now pinkish blood. You can't be dead, Gifford told them. Or maybe he was trying to assure himself. At that moment, he couldn't be certain. There was something about seeing Tesh's scattered teeth that made Gifford want to vomit. Yet he had no stomach or bile, just the horror revealed through his non-existent eyes. As he tried to cope with being trapped in a bad dream wrapped in a nightmare, Gifford was nearly crushed by a huge rock that smashed into the permafrost. Another boulder struck, then two more. Huge slabs fell, shaking the ground and exploding the ice into clouds of snow. He suspected Feral was lobbing stones to crush them. Gifford grabbed hold of Tesh and Tressa and dragged their bodies towards the nearest cliff wall, hoping for shelter. As it turned out, the rain of stone didn't last long.
Gif,
Fudd. The coarse, croaking voice came from Tressa, a sound that scared him well past death. Her eyes were still open and remained unfocused.
Help me, Geffard. Please. It hurts. Please.
The one-time crippled Potter looked from Tressa to Tesh. Both of them were stretched out from being dragged, and bits and pieces of each were left behind. Helplessness was too simple a concept for what he felt.
I don't know how.
Fine. Help.
Tesh managed to say, his jaw still attached, but just barely.
Find help. Here.
Gifford looked around. All he saw was a vast, empty, and uninviting plain of cruel, crystal-white frost. There would be no aid. They'd reached the end, their eternal resting place. This was the abyss. Chapter 2. Seasons shift to winter. Winter has a tendency to creep up like an old woman with a blanket who is intent on smothering the world. The Book of Bryn. Nolan got up and rushed outside when he heard the shouting. At 5.5 years old, Persephone's sandy-haired son was as excited as a squirrel with 2 acorns and as agile as a mountain goat. The former she chalked up to being a child, the latter came from his father. Nolan halted and waited for her. Mama? Persephone drew back the flap. Snow was still falling, heavy flakes taking their time. This was the 4th snow of the season, but the 1st stubborn enough to stick. The tent roofs were already white. The brown grass was covered, and the pathways that had been a muddy mess the day before were now pristine, except for a pair of tracks left by an early riser. Persephone had always wondered at the irony of winter, a season that bestowed beauty and death in equal measure. The world had been transformed overnight, in both appearance and sound. Even at such an early hour, the camp was usually ringing with activity. But the white blanket had smothered everything, leaving the world muffled until the shouts arrived with undeniable intent. Cries of joy they are not.
What's happening? Nolan asked.
Too short to see, he futilely jumped in place to get a look, tapping the endless reserve of energy that all children possessed. Persephone wished she could borrow some. The days were getting shorter, and she still didn't have the strength to push through them. She was 45, going on eternity. But her age was only part of the problem. Guilt played its part, and fear took its toll. Sikar appeared an instant later, hood up, his breath puffing clouds. As promised, Nefren had appointed him as her new shield. The one-time captain of Alan Rist hadn't said so, but Persephone was certain he resented babysitting a rune.
Back inside and get your cloak, she said to her son.
Nolan looked at her, eyes wide, his little mouth forming a big O. For him, taking that additional minute to dress against the weather was absurd.
Go on. You won't see what's happening until you have your wool.
Even with this threat, she still had to pull her son inside. Justine was sleeping, curled up at the foot of the bed. Nolan started to wake her, but Persephone stopped him.
Leave her be.
Persephone wrapped Nolan in his mini Lee Moore, pinning the shoulder while he huffed but didn't move. His effort to stand still was admirable, but also calculated. He'd do anything to speed up the process. When she was done, he was a perfect image of a Clan Wren child. Except for the green eyes.
What does that mean?
In a world of brown-eyed runes and blue-eyed Frey, Nolan was unique. Snowflakes had stuck to her son's eyelashes, making him more striking than usual.
Even taking into account her motherly bias, Persephone believed there had never been so beautiful a child. The brutish features of men were smoothed by the elegance of his frey blood. Likewise, his rune heritage helped to dampen the inherent appearance of contemptuous superiority worn by his father's kin. Her job would be to ensure that Nolan never rose to his full potential. An odd task for a mother, but no woman had ever birthed a son like Nolan. Persephone wasn't so naive as to assume that her people would win the war, but if they did somehow, everything would change, and her child of two worlds could one day rule all of mankind. She had to make him worthy, and with Nephron as a father, that would be a challenge. She needed to fight his influence, battle against Nephron's unconscious prejudice and arrogance. And she'd have to get lucky. Persephone was concerned that being half-human, Nolan might have a shorter lifespan than his father. She wasn't certain of this, but the boy did look primarily human. He lacked the pointed ears and delicate frame of the Frey, and his hair was sandy-colored rather than a startlingly bright blonde. If the gods denied him a long life, what would happen when Nolan, who would be raised as a prince-in-waiting, learned his father would outlive him by centuries? This made her worry that an egotistical son might resent an eternal father who blocked ascension to the first chair. Either way, she wouldn't live to see the outcome, and had only a handful of years to direct the course the future would take. She was swinging blindly into a fog at a foe that might not exist, and the fate of humanity lay in the balance. But that concern was for tomorrow. On this snowy morning, she took the hand of an innocent boy who grinned up at her without a care. For him, the world seemed a wondrous place, and at that moment, it was for her as well. In a heartbeat, all that changed. Soldiers raced through the fresh snow, moving as if chased. 8 men in woodland armor ran across the field toward the camp. Bursts of white kicked up in front of their feet. Any deeper, and they wouldn't have been able to run, but the snow was still falling, still building. If it keeps up, no one will be able to walk, let alone run. Persephone reflected on the thought as if it were an unwanted prophecy. She hadn't been thinking in terms of flight, but seeing the dread in the faces of the men running at her, she wondered if she should have. Persephone, Nolan, and Sikar made it to the broad pathway that separated the healing quarter from the area where auxiliary troops were housed. The shouts had carried, and everywhere men opened tent flaps and exited with cautious eyes. Some threw on boots and cloaks, but still more remained wrapped in blankets, peering at the uninviting dawn and the unwanted gifts it delivered. Reaching the camp's boundary, Nolan pointed at the running men.
"Who are they?"
"Teklors," she replied. While she puzzled on what could drive a troop of Teklors to take flight, she saw they were not alone. More men emerged from the curtain of falling snow. In a broad, dark line, they appeared as phantoms, a moving shadow wall along the plain. "It's a full retreat," Nephron said, coming up from behind. He said it softly, the words slipping out. He wasn't speaking to them. He wasn't speaking to anyone.
"Hi, Dada,"
Nolan grinned up at him, waving with his free hand. "What do you think is going on?" Persephone asked.
"I suspect we'll know shortly," Nephron replied, "but I wouldn't expect good news."
"Hi, Dada,"
the boy repeated, louder this time. Nephron looked at his son and frowned.
"Why aren't you bigger?"
"I am big," the boy corrected.
"For a mouse, perhaps. But if you're going to be my son, you need to grow, and faster."
"How?"
"Think bigger thoughts."
"Okay,"
Nolan said, as if the advice made perfect sense. Maybe to him it did. But somewhere in that idea, Persephone felt a lurking dread. A panting Edgar ran toward them. His face was red, nose a bluish beet.
Snow gathered on his beard, and ice crystals had formed around his mouth.
Report,
Nefren ordered, while the Techlaw commander was still several strides away. Edgar stopped and puffed a fog for several seconds, giving Atkins the chance to catch up. The two men were still in their layered green and brown tatters that made them look like shambling mounds of leaves, the shoulders of which were frosted white.
They've got one, sir,
Edgar managed to say, between gulps of breath. Persephone took a faltering step. Concerned about discussing military matters in front of her son, she turned. Sikar, escort Nolan back to my tent. Wake Justine and tell her to take him to breakfast. The Frey commander glared and made no sign of moving. Persephone wasn't in the habit of giving any of the Frey orders, much less the senior camp commander. He wasn't pleased, but Persephone had greater concerns than Sikar's pride.
Have you forgotten the way to the Koenig's tent, Sikar?
Nefren asked.
I'm not a nursemaid, the Instaria replied, keeping his tone even but cold.
This is your shield to the Koenig and the Koenig's son. Do your job.
Sikar frowned, but took the boy's hand and led him back down the trail.
Are you sure there's only one?
Nefren asked Edgar.
That's all we saw, sir. One was enough. We were on our way back to our station when it attacked the forward encampment. I don't expect there'll be any additional survivors.
Edgar looked back toward the wood.
The dragon set the camp and forest ablaze. You can't see the smoke because of the falling snow, but the trees are burning. I thought it was better to report than engage.
Persephone watched the snow, which at that moment made it seem as if the sky was falling, flake by tiny flake. After dismissing the rest of the Techlaws and the remaining men from the woods who had followed them, Persephone, Nefren, and Edgar moved to the comfort and privacy of the Koenig's tent. She ordered food to be brought for the Techlaw, but her stomach was so braided in knots she couldn't consider eating. Nefren also declined, but she suspected his reasons were different than hers. After years of deadlocked inaction, he had something to do, something he was especially good at. The Galarabrin has a limited range, Persephone said. If it was created at Avimpartha, it can't travel past the Harwood. Lothian's troops won't be able to use it this far out. Nefren rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
Do you know the exact range of the dragon?
Persephone shook her head. No, not precisely. Maybe Lothian doesn't know either. He may not even be aware there is a limitation. If that's so, we remain at a stalemate. For now. They can't attack our position because of our dragon, and we can no longer approach Avimpartha because of theirs.
But won't they just make more and continue to advance?
Edgar asked, after swallowing a mouthful of day-old bread and salted meat. Persephone wished she could have offered better. These men deserve so much more.
That's what I would have done if I had a means to cross and Sori hadn't refused to make more,
Nefren answered.
But first I would have established a foothold on the other side of the river and used a dragon as protection while I massed my troops.
Lothian has no military prowess, and if he's expecting his dragon to overrun and destroy us, he probably didn't plan for that essential middle step.
Persephone ignored the comment about Suri and appreciated that Nefren didn't say more on the subject.
He could have. He had every right. Maybe her husband saw no point in going down that rabbit hole. They both knew it was Persephone's fault. She had been the one who delivered the mystic to the Fane.
Nefren, who had been sitting in one of the soft chairs, stood up and looked to the north. At this moment, there's nothing preventing the Fane from advancing to the edge of this camp and making a dragon right on our doorstep. If he did that, he let his arms fall in resignation, it would be over.
So, what do we do? Edgar asked.
He turned to face the soldier.
Is anyone left back there? Any defenders at all?
Don't know for sure. We left right away. Some at the river may have escaped or were out of the camp at the time. If so, I suspect they'll be coming here. You will need to return to the forest. Edgar looked shocked. The Harwood is on fire, sir. That's not my concern. Persephone interjected. They can't fight a Gilarabrin. He turned his attention to her. Edgar and his Teclaws are alive because Lothian's dragon has a limited range, just like ours. I need to know what that distance is, and I need to prevent the Fane from gathering troops on our side of the Nidwalden. That army will not be limited. Most important, I need to ensure that no Myrilith escapes that wood. We cannot afford to let them anywhere near us. We'll need more men. I'll send for reinforcements. How many do you require? She asked. All of them, Nephron replied. Is it really so dire? Our overwhelming numbers are the only advantage we still possess. And yes, it's precisely that ruinous. In fact, we should break camp as soon as possible. He hesitated, as if the words were poisonous. We'll need to retreat. The reinforcements will have to be sent to our new rally point. Are you sure? Persephone said. This position is no longer tenable. We should fall back to the farthest reaches of our dragon. The distance between Elonrist and Meridid is about the same as between Elonrist and here, so the dragon ought to be able to come with us. Will it? I'm not sure. Suri controlled it on the way here, but... She hesitated. Even now. The words were seared into her heart. Yes, I think it will come, Persephone finished. Good, Nephron nodded, his eyes shifting in thought. But what good will retreating do, sir? Atkins asked. Aren't we just putting off the inevitable? No, Persephone answered. Making a dragon comes at a terrible cost. Each one they are forced to make may weaken the resolve of the Fane's forces. She looked at Nephron. With such bitter alternatives before them, it's possible they might seek peace. I think that option is forever off the table, Nephron said. Edgar, eat the rest of your meal walking. Get your men, gather those from the other encampments, and take half our reserves. Send a runner with daily reports about the number of Frey on our side of the river. Don't let them out of those trees unless they make another dragon. And if they do? Fall back and join with the reinforcements. Yes, sir. Edgar saluted, grabbed another handful of food, and exited the tent. With his departure, a long silence fell between them. Persephone was reticent about raising the subject again, but she needed to ask. She's dead, isn't she? Sorry, Nephron asked. Yes, I believe so. No reason to keep her breathing now that she's given up the only value she had. It wasn't what he said, but rather the matter-of-fact way in which he said it that Persephone found most upsetting. Would you have preferred that I lie? She shook her head. No. Nephron wasn't the worst husband, but he wasn't the best either. Reglan had had many faults, but he would have held Persephone's head to his chest and wrapped her in the security of his arms while she cried. He understood her need for such things. The Frey she married didn't have a clue. This failure wasn't Nephron's fault. Such behavior simply wasn't in his nature. Without meaning to, she found herself staring at the black bronze sword mounted on the center pole of her tent. Birds fly, fish swim, she thought. Then, after considering further, she realized... Ducks did both. I see you're thinking the same thing I am, Nephron said. Persephone doubted that very much. What are you thinking? She asked, turning toward him. He pointed at the blade she had been looking at. We shouldn't have that sword here. It's a liability. How so? The Fane's forces are no longer contained. And it's the only thing that can kill Sori's dragon. Isn't that right? Persephone was surprised he knew about that.
They hadn't discussed it before. Yes, the symbols on the blade are its name. It's the knot that binds the weave. If it penetrates the Gilarabrun's body, the enchantment breaks and the creature vanishes. Right, so what's to stop one of the Thane's forces from stealing it and destroying our best defense? Well, first he'd have to know that such a thing exists. Second, he'd have to learn that I have it. Third, he'd have to get close enough to use it, and I don't think the Gilarabrun will allow that. Malcolm gave it to me so that Suri wouldn't have to be the one to put it to rest. But now that I think about it...
What?
Maybe he knew Suri wouldn't be around. And that's why he gave it to me. He said to keep it safe. It never occurred to me to ask why. Lately, I've been suspecting Malcolm is a seer, able to foretell the future like Tora or Suri. He seems to know things he shouldn't. Nephron sighed. Don't waste your time trying to figure Malcolm out. He's an enigma. But I'll grant you, there is more to him than meets the eye. Still, at the very least, you should hide that blade. The tide has turned, Persephone. We need to be cautious and use every advantage we have, or we'll lose this war. She nodded and glanced at the sword once more. It glimmered in the early morning light. I'll ask Malcolm about it. Wonderful, he said sarcastically. While you're at it, ask him what the weather will be like in Meridid. Chapter 3 Saving Moya. If there is anything I learned from dying, it is the simple truth that no matter how bleak, terrible, or impossible things might seem, they can always get worse, and all too often, they do. The Book of Brynn. Moya saw the bridge break and fall. She'd been carried to the Queen by a Bancor, and was now being restrained by a big man, or perhaps a small giant. He gripped her from behind, so all she knew for certain was that he smelled of sweat and blood. His hand clutched her arm so hard it hurt. They prevented her from escaping, but as Moya watched the bridge shatter, they also kept her from collapsing. A moment before, the Queen had asked her who had the key. Moya tried to resist answering, but it was like holding her breath. No matter how much she wanted not to, eventually she had to inhale. The disappointment was how little time it took to break her. Less than a minute, but it had been the collapse of the bridge that took the strength from her legs. She'd seen them go down. First Roan, then Brynn, Gifford, and finally Tesh and Tressa. The route to the Alison door was destroyed, and the key forever out of reach. Moya had failed Persephone and humanity as a whole, and she had lost her friends. Somehow, she still existed, but they did not. It made no sense. She had been in charge. All of it's my fault. I'm responsible. How is it that I'm here and they're gone? That's not how it should be. For the first time, Moya felt truly dead. The hands that held her let go, and she dropped, crumpling to the stone at the edge of the broken tongue of the bridge. She sat dazed, gaping at the missing piece near the center. They're not dead. They can't be dead. You can't die when you're already in pyre. Waking from the depths of a nightmare, she looked around. The Queen was gone, as were her hideous Bancors and Orr. All around Moya, the armies were breaking up. Men, Frey, dwarves, giants, and goblins were walking away. A quiet dispersal. The hosts neither cheered nor laughed. Melin and some others carried the brutalized bodies of Gath and Bran. Most remained where they had fallen. Hundreds of bodies littered the landscape. Fenelius, helped Midian, who was slow to move, limping as he went.
"What's going on?"
Moya called to them. Fen looked back at her.
"We lost. And it's over. Everyone just goes home?"
"Yes. That's how it is here."
"But no. It can't be over. We have to get them out. My friends who fell. We have to do something."
Fenelaus shook her head. "Not possible. And yes, it's over. And yes, it's pointless. It always is. That's why I stopped participating in these futile antics. I only returned because of you. This time was supposed to be different. Beatrice said you and your friends were special." Fenelaus sighed and shook her head again. "You weren't." The fray resumed, helping Midian walk away.
"It's not over," Moya shouted after her. "There must be some way to help them."
"There isn't." Fenelaus's tone was as absolute as a slammed door.
"Come back with us, Moya," Midian said, his voice weak and small. "We will drink and rest, and tomorrow will be better. It always is."
Moya looked back out at the void, at the yawning mouth of the abyss.
"No, I can't leave them like this."
She stood up.
"I refuse to walk away and abandon them."
She took a step toward the brink.
"Moya,"
Rain said. He was behind her somewhere.
"Leave me alone, Rain."
"But Moya, over there, look."
She was aware that the digger knew what she was planning. He'd tackled Gifford to prevent him from jumping off the bridge, and now he was trying to stop her, too. She wouldn't let that happen. Yet something in his tone made her look. The dwarf was pointing at a mass of bodies just before the bridge. These were the ones who had walked into Midian's great axe and Melon's hammers. More than a dozen were left, abandoned by the queen. One face stood out.
"Tekchin!"
Rushing over, Moya dropped to her knees.
"Rain, help me!"
Together, they rolled bodies off the Instaria, revealing a grisly sight. Tekchin had fought valiantly. No mere stab wound had taken him down. Moya had seen butchered pigs that were more intact. An arm was missing. His head was nearly severed, and deep slices across his chest and thighs had gone through his armor as if it was cloth. Freeing him from the pile wasn't easy. They couldn't pull or drag, for fear he would separate further.
"Tekchin! Tekchin!"
Moya was nearly blinded as she sobbed.
"Rain, help me!"
The dwarf was there. He'd found a cloth, a banner of some sort. Spreading it out, they gingerly laid Tekchin on it.
"We can drag him now," Rain said. "He'll be all right. It will take time, but he'll recover."
Moya continued to cry, but managed to nod.
"He'll recover faster and with less pain if you're with him," Beatrice said.
The little white-haired seer was sitting on a shelf of stone a few yards away. She'd likely been there all along, but became visible as the crowd thinned. Moya spat on the ground.
"You knew this was going to happen. This is what you refused to tell us."
"Yes," Beatrice said.
"You asked us to trust you."
"I didn't lie. I told you things would be bad. Very bad. And then they would get worse. That's the truth, wouldn't you say? But you withheld information.
Why?"
The little dwarf stood up and looked out at the broken bridge.
"Because you wouldn't have come if you'd known the cost. Especially that it would be them paying the price rather than yourself. You would have taken the key and ordered the rest to remain safely in the castle. They would have protested with plenty of tears and shouts, but in the end, you would have gotten your way. As a result, The queen would have taken the key, the gates of Pyre would be thrown wide, and your little war centered on the Nidwalden River would be forgotten, replaced with a new conflict, one too massive and terrible to imagine. I know. I've seen it hundreds of times. The Goldrock is the center of a maze that all paths go through. There is no way to avoid it. Not yet, at least.
If there is no avoiding it, then why not choose an alternative where they didn't have to fall?
Because we need new paths, new options.
Moya spat again and wiped her nose.
You gambled with my friends, with the eternity of their souls.
Beatrice turned to face her.
This isn't a game, Moya. And you still have a part to play, so I can't tell you anything more except Tekchin needs you. Love, knowing someone cares about you, is a powerful medicine, both on Alan and especially in here. It gives a person hope, and that is unbelievably powerful.
Chapter 4. Losing the Light. All too often, that which we are most certain of is that which we are most wrong about. And that which we are wrong about can change everything. The Book of Bryn. Gifford wandered the bleak landscape of craggy rocks, which were coated with layers of crystallized frost. Each step made a declarative crunch. Too loud, he thought, although he didn't know why. The abyss was desolate, deserted, and depressing. In comparison, Dorea, with its brittle grasses, vast skies, and cloudscapes, was a paradise of life and beauty. Gifford wandered the open plain between the two cliffs with no specific direction. He searched for help in a place he suspected held none. He felt heavy, burdened and slow. Plus, his hip still hurt from the fall. The injury got worse the more he moved. Or maybe he'd misjudged the initial extent of the damage. Walking was painful and noticeably tiring, at least in comparison with how it had been since his death. Contrasted with the 30 years he had lived, this was an almost insignificant hindrance. Certainly when viewed against the backdrop of his inability to help Tesh and Tressa. And then there was Rome, or rather, the lack of her, that made his quest all the more desperate. The abyss, he discovered, was a realm of hopelessness. Stepping down to a lower shelf of rock, Gifford's hip twinged in pain. He put a hand to his side and worked at rubbing away the hurtful spasm. The effort succeeded, and the sensation faded.
No body, he reminded himself. The pain is self-inflicted.
This conjured a new and bewildering question.
Why had Tressa and Tesh suffered so much more from their falls?
The two had resembled collapsed tents, spread out in gruesome displays. Despite knowing they lacked bodies, they puddled in pain and wallowed in anguish. Gifford stepped up onto another shelf and felt the stab in his hip again.
And I can't erase this idea of a wound that is getting worse.
This realization disturbed Gifford.
What does that mean? It seems we are our own worst enemies.
A sound. He heard it, or thought he had. Gifford stopped and listened. Staring out into the dark, he tried to will it so.
Nothing. Just wishful thinking.
But in the absence of anything else, Gifford embraced hope and imagined the sound had come from a nearby rock wall. So he veered toward it. Vertical fissures appeared as violent scars in the dark grey stone, the claw marks of some colossal beast. As he neared a cleft at its base, Gifford heard voices, or, more precisely, a voice.
Something is inside.
Gifford was aware he had thought something instead of someone. He remembered Bryn telling him about a row she had overheard in Alan Rist, and that certainly couldn't be described as a person. But in this new world, anything might be possible. Only the mental picture of Tesh's and Tressa's mashed bodies begging him for help drove him inside. Entering slowly, Gifford took time to allow his light to peel back the mystery of the interior. The entrance was narrow, but the fissure widened as he went deeper. He paused to listen. No sound. Maybe I'm mistaken. Caves were usually empty things. The noise had been so slight. I was wrong. This is the abyss. It's nothing but a void.
You've been a naughty girl, haven't you?
A voice issued from deeper in the cave.
A very, very bad girl.
I know that voice.
You poisoned Daddy. Fed me something terrible, and then watched me die, frothing like one of Gilston's sheep. I can see why you landed here. The gods can't forgive a killing like that.
Oh, dear mother of all, not him. And who is he talking to?
Gifford knew the answer, though he shoved it away, denied it the right to be.
No, he thought, not her, not him.
Moving deeper, rushing forward, Gifford's light revealed the answer. Ivar the Carver stood crouched in a small pocket chamber. He looked soft, fat, and greasy. Gifford hadn't noticed before, but seeing that pasty face and bags for cheeks and that extra ring of neck, he realized Ivar was the only one on the doll to have cut such a round figure.
He wasn't just fat and sagging due to his weight. He looked melted, like a candle left in the sun. Ivar stooped over something that lay on the ground.
How's my daughter, hey?
Ivar cooed.
Daughter?
Ivar noticed the light and turned. The wax man was dressed in rags, remnants of a long-forgotten tunic. Torn and threadbare as spiderwebs, the unraveled ends waved in the same eerie, undulating motion as long hair underwater. Spittle glistened on Ivar's lower lip, and as small as his eyes were, they were wide with an eager joy. As Ivar turned, Gifford saw past him and gasped. Roan lay at his feet. She didn't move except to quiver, didn't speak except to moan. Instantly, the cave grew bright as Gifford's rage flared.
Let go of my wife,
he shouted.
Gifford? Gifford? The cripple?
Ivar stared in shock, backing up. Gifford wasn't wearing armor, didn't have his sword, but none of that mattered. He charged with fury and a raised fist.
I said let her go!
The quiet potter of Dol Ren shook, but not with cold. His eyes were wide and wild, his jaw clenched. Ivar cowered.
Touch her again, Gifford shouted, and I'll find a rock and spend eternity bashing your head in. You got that?
He was screaming then.
Do you understand me, you sick son of a bitch? You stay away from her!
Ivar disappeared into the dark recesses of the cave as Gifford reached down and gently lifted Roan in his arms. She continued to cry as Gifford carried her out.
Don't go out there,
Ivar said from the shadows.
It's not safe. The light! They will come for you!
At the sound of his voice, Roan shuddered.
It's okay, Roan, he whispered. I've got you. He's gone. He won't touch you anymore, I promise.
I swear I'll tear him apart with my bare hands if he ever does, so help me. With Eaton as my witness and Alan as my judge, I swear it.
By the time Gifford carried Roan back to the others, things had improved. While they still lay broken on the frost, both Tesh and Tressa had recovered somewhat. Instead of appearing crushed, Tesha's head merely looked as if he'd been horribly beaten with a stout stick. Teeth were still missing, and his nose was askew. But at least his jaw seemed to be working. Tressa had not recovered nearly so much, though she had rolled to her side, and her twisted limbs had resumed what resembled proper alignment. Both could talk again.
"You found Rome," Tesh said.
His head tilted slightly as he struggled to see. His jaw was working, but Tesh's voice was weak and shaky. Gifford nodded as he laid Roan beside Tressa. He started to draw away, but Roan surprised him by latching onto his arm with surprising strength.
"Don't leave me."
"I'm not going anywhere," he assured her. "And you should know by now, I'll never leave you."
Just the same, Roan pulled him into an embrace and held on.
"So scared."
"If I could kill him for you, I would."
"Who?"
Tesh asked.
"Ivar the Carver."
"Ivar is down here?"
Tressa asked, then winced in pain from the effort. Which wound troubled her was beyond Gifford's ability to reckon. The woman was battered such that he couldn't look at her.
"He took Roan."
"And you found him?"
Despite her obvious agony, Tressa managed to grin.
"How'd that go?"
"I didn't need to do anything. I just yelled."
"Really? You let him go?"
Gifford rolled his shoulders.
"Roan's all I care about."
He brushed the hair from her face. When he'd first found her, she had looked terrible. Not as bad as Tressa, but not far behind. Her face had been black and blue, bleeding from a dozen cuts. Like Tesh, some of her front teeth had been missing, her nose crushed, and one eye was pooling with blood. Now, her teeth were back. Her eye was still red, but clearing, and her nose only had a bad bruise. Like the others, she, too, was recovering. Each reclaimed a sense of themselves, but at different rates. Roan outpaced the others, and as he watched, the bruises began receding.
"You look so much better," he told her, tears watering his eyes.
"You're bringing me back,"
she whispered, her lips trembling.
"Do you know where Bryn is?"
Tesh asked, his voice growing more steady as he spoke.
"See any trace of her out there?"
Gifford shook his head.
"There's nothing. Wouldn't have found Roan if I hadn't heard Ivar's voice. He had dragged her into a cave."
Gifford searched his wife's face.
"Did he do anything to you?"
Roan shook her head, eyes fixed on him, as if unable to let go even for a moment.
"Didn't have time. He had more trouble carrying me than you did. He was exhausted from the effort. Thank you, Gifford. Thank you. I was so scared. To be alone. All alone. With him."
Roan shuddered.
"I love you," he said. "I always have, and always will."
As if the words were magic, Roan calmed. She wiped tears from her eyes, and under her own power rose to a sitting position. Then she smiled at him.
"You're my hero."
At the sound of those words and the sight of her happy face, Gifford realized he no longer felt pain. The ache of his hip was gone, and he felt, oddly, lighter.
"You're brighter,"
Roan said. She took a moment to study him.
"You're light. It's more brilliant than before. Brighter than when you first found me."
He shrugged.
"You bring me back too, I guess."
"Good thing," Tressa said. "Dark down here, wherever here is."
Roan looked up toward the absent sky.
"Did anyone else fall?"
"Bryn did,"
Tesh said, then grunted as he struggled to lift his head.
"So heavy. Can barely move." "Like water,"
Roan said.
"When you dive under, the weight of the water increases the deeper you go, pressing down."
They each looked up and nodded as if they could see the weight.
I think this is what Tressa and Tesh were feeling up there,
Ron pointed.
But down here, with depth, it's worse. It's terrible. You feel it, don't you, Gifford?
He shrugged.
A little. It was worse before. Not so bad now. Just feel a bit sluggish is all.
I wonder what happened to Bryn, Tesh said. This Ivor guy. Do you think he might have done something to her too?
I didn't see her, Gifford said. If I had, believe me, I would have brought her back too.
Of course, I didn't mean...
Tesh swallowed, and Gifford couldn't help but think it was blood filling his mouth.
I'm just scared.
Trust me, I understand.
Ron shook her head. Bryn wasn't there. Just me and Ivor. He talked as if I were a present sent to him by the gods. I couldn't move. Couldn't talk.
She shivered.
You're safe with me now. I'm not a cripple anymore, and I might not be able to kill that old bastard, but if he ever threatens you again, I'll make him wish I could.
I'm not scared, she told him, and once more she pulled him close and laid her head on his shoulder. It's just that it's cold down here.
She shivered again, and seeing her do so had the same effect as witnessing a yawn. Tressa began to shiver, and then Tesh did as well.
It is cold, isn't it?
Gifford looked around, searching for a solution. But he saw only the unending broken plain, the root cellar of the world.
Maybe we should make another fire.
Ron's eyes widened with fear.
I don't think the Queen can reach us down here, Ron.
Gifford glanced up, but saw nothing. No Queen, Bankors, or even the top of the crevasse. Everything beyond the reach of Gifford's light was the same. Darkness.
Don't think anyone can.
Ron shook her head.
Nothing to burn.
Don't need anything. It's not real fire.
Ron trapped her quivering lower lip between her teeth. She looked back at him with trepidation.
I don't know how to, without wood.
She seemed worried about letting him down.
That's okay, he told her. I don't even know if we can make fire here.
The abyss felt like another place, a forgotten corner of the afterlife. And who knew what worked or didn't at the bottom of the world? In Rel and the upper levels of Nifril, people were able to use their Ashim to craft their surroundings into a place of their liking. But this place was a blank canvas.
No, not a canvas.
The frame. Gifford imagined all of Pyre might have been like the abyss when the first dead arrived. The weight and pressure wasn't as crippling in the Highlands, so those like Ferrol and Drome had been able to exert their wills and craft a place to their liking. But down in the depths of the abyss, wills were crushed, and Ashim in short supply. There wasn't enough to alter the landscape.
It's not the fire that's important. We're looking at it all wrong. We're not really even cold.
It's the idea of warmth that we need. I do feel warmer beside you,
Ron admitted.
He nodded. It's like the well in the Wren village in Rel. More people, more Ashim.
Ron looked at the open expanse.
The cold isn't real, but the idea is. We think it's freezing because it looks that way. Out here in the open, on this frozen ground, we can't help thinking icy thoughts.
If we can find shelter, someplace small like Ivor's cave, we might be able to imagine our body heat warming one another. I think that would help.
Then we could work on finding a way out of here.
Gifford considered driving Ivor out and taking his cave, but he suspected that revisiting his place might be worse for Ron than sitting in the open.
A way out,
Tressa said. Stunned.
We fell, he said. Seems reasonable we can climb out, right?
No, it doesn't.
Well, sure, Gifford admitted.
Right now, nothing feels possible. But once we find shelter, everything will seem better. Roan, can you walk?
I think so. She bent her legs, pushing to her knees. I think maybe. Yes.
Gifford looked at Tesh.
I'm not going anywhere.
The man was still laid out on the stone. Gifford didn't bother asking Tressa. The woman resembled a sack of snapped sticks.
He couldn't carry them all. It's hopeless.
Gifford, Roan said, what's wrong? Your light. It's dimming again.
Sorry, I don't know what causes that.
Hope, she said. Faith, maybe. That's what must give us the power to push back against the dark.
Foolish optimism, Tressa said, which I just don't get, by the way.
She lifted her eyes to stare at Gifford, because lifting her head appeared impossible.
You lived a life of misery, spat on by everyone, including the gods. No, especially the gods. I was better off than you, for a time, at least. Then you're granted a handful of not entirely appalling years. And now you're Mr. Sunshine, all bright and cheerful. How's that possible?
I have Roan, he replied, and very low expectations. It doesn't take much to make me happy.
But you're not happy, Roan said. Your light, it's still getting weaker. What's wrong?
Gifford tried to will himself brighter, but that didn't work.
I don't know what to do. All of you are hurt. I want to help, but I don't know how. I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed and a lot scared.
We're dragging you down with us, Roan said.
Gifford's light grew fainter.
You're no weight to me, Roan.
I'm certainly no support, Tressa said.
Tesh, who had been trying to roll to his side, gave up. Roan, too, settled back to resting on her elbows.
I'm losing them,
Gifford thought, and once more his light weakened. Roan said, squeezing him.
Don't let it get to...
Her words were slurred.
Her mouth. Something was wrong with it. Her front teeth. She's missing them again.
Gifford felt the cold rush in. He shivered, and his light, once as strong as a lantern in the night, became little more than a flickering candle. He felt the weight pushing down, pinning him to the frost. He clutched Roan, wrapped his arms around her, squeezing tight. There was still warmth there, still hope as long as he had her.
I love you, he said,
hoping the magic would work again. Roan looked up and smiled, showing perfect teeth. Tressa, who by then was lying with her cheek on the frost, staring out across the plain like a dead body, whispered,
What empire is that?
In the distance, a light appeared, a dazzling sight just above the horizon.
It's like the morning star, Roan said.
Don't go out there, Iva had warned. It's not safe. The light. They will come for you.
It's getting bigger.
Gifford hugged Roan tighter until he was afraid he might hurt her.
It's coming at us.
Fearfully gazing at the brilliance that grew larger by the second, the four held their collective breath. They lay directly in its path.
Who are they?
Gifford wondered. A moment later, he realized it wasn't a they, but a who. And she was beyond brilliant. Running up to them, Bryn shouted, Tesh! To find anyone in the abyss was wonderful. To find him was a joy. Yet this was the last place she would have wished Tesh to be. He looked terrible, all mangled, mutilated, and sprawled out on the hard ground. Tressa looked worse. Roan was better, Gifford the best, but none of them looked good.
You're alive! Bryn caught herself. You're okay.
Tash put up a hand to shield his eyes and peered at her.
Bryn?
She came close and watched as his face, bruised as it was, shifted from confused to elated.
It's me, she told him. You're all right. I'm fine.
Well, she looked behind her. There were these scary things after me, but I think I lost them. They don't move very fast, and I'm pretty quick. I'm hoping that once I got out of their sight, they stopped. Even if they didn't, it ought to take them about a year to get this far. Tesh's hands inched off the ground. They shook with the effort, but he managed to cup Bryn's face. Cradling it ever so gently, he pulled her to him, and they kissed. He was shuddering, his whole body quaking.
I'm so sorry, Bryn. I failed you. Wraith begged me to take you away, to find a peaceful little place where we could make a new life together. He was showing me how to live, to really live. I should have listened. I was the last Durean, and because of me, because I didn't listen to the man who was like a father to me, my entire clan is gone.
Tears welled in Bryn's eyes. The man who had been so strong, so confident and capable, now lay before her, broken and frail. She didn't trust her voice to speak.
It doesn't even matter if you can't love me, he went on, filling the silence. I love you, and I should have married you. I should have listened to Wraith and taken you away and had children.
His voice broke. He gave up the effort and hugged her.
I love you too, Bryn managed. And we can still have all those things Wraith wanted as soon as we get out of here. How can you love me? You know what I did.
Yes, I do.
You followed me into the pool. That's not what I meant.
She smiled at him.
I love you, Tesh. Don't ask me to explain it, I just do. I don't understand.
Tesh, loving you isn't something I decide. It isn't a choice. Maybe I shouldn't love you, but I do. It's not something I control.
That doesn't make sense.
Doesn't have to. Not everything is logical. Scales don't need to be balanced. Wrongs don't need to be righted.
I'm not like you, Tesh. He's not like you either, Tressa said. He's an idiot. Maybe, Gifford said. But he's standing.
Chapter 5 Inconvenient Daughters. You never know who you will meet, even after you have met them. The Book of Bryn.
I don't know what's wrong with me.
Imali felt sick. She'd been feeling horrible and getting worse.
Maybe I'm too old for this.
The thought had rattled inside her head for days, growing louder as it fought to be heard.